This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Absolutely jam-packed episode for you today as we talk to Emma Edwards of The Broke Generation. How could your philosophy, your mentality, your psychology about finances be affecting how you spend? Really insightful chat. Can't wait for you to hear it. Also talking travel. Have the heat waves in Europe caused you to change any plans? What impact could that have on future tourism? Sarah Pickford from Travel Counsellors sharing insights and trends. And then it was about travel etiquette as we spoke to an expert from Berkeley Etiquette. The things that drive you insane about your fellow passengers on the plane. Plus, Moorfield Eye Hospital on hand. Dr. Zaher talking about dry eyes and taking your questions too. Travel. And this week, Athens authorities had to close the Acropolis due to temperatures soaring past 40 degrees in central and southern Greece. And Greece, not the only European nation experiencing an early onset of extreme heat, raising concerns about a repeat of last year's severe weather patterns. Mediterranean tourist destinations particularly affected. Turkey's coastal temperatures hitting 12 degrees above seasonal averages, wildfires breaking out in Cyprus, and of course the deadly impact of extreme heat evident as seen in Mecca, where dozens of lives were lost due to scorching conditions. So let me know, does the climate, does weather affect where you go? Have you changed any of your plans in light of these recent headlines? And is it still possible to bag a bargain? Offering the industry insider's take, we've got Sarah Pickford from Travel Counsellors joining us live, and happy to take your questions, your comments as ever on 4001. You're looking well, Sarah. How are you going?
Thank you very much, Helen. Nice to be here. Thank you.
It's busy, hey?
It is, yeah. And, you know, looking well. I'm probably just a bit hot and bothered. I was in the Maldives until last night.
Oh, so you can go off, people, I find. I liked you about 30 seconds ago. Can I ask where you were staying? Any recommendations?
Well, I was at Sun Siam Al Huveli and also Siam World, which are two really popular family-friendly resorts hosted by Sun Siam. Honestly, very well recommended for children and families. I, yesterday, did go-karting in the Maldives. And after I left, some colleagues of mine were horse riding along the beach.
Gosh.
That is amazing.
Because, you know, for a long time it has been, if you want to go and maybe snorkel or snuggle, those are the two things to do in the Maldives. Now we're seeing go-karting, golf, riding. Just amazing, really, how a lot of these places have adapted to this idea of we're not just a honeymoon destination, we're a family destination, and some of the different tiers of budget. And yeah, really, it's a really interesting one for us because it is an easy flight from the UAE and one that's becoming more affordable as more airlines offer routes there.
Absolutely. It's probably still our biggest destination for guests from the UAE. It's an all-year-round destination. When I joined Travel Counsellors 11 years ago, in the summer, a lot of resorts were actually closed for refurbishment and whatnot. Now they're open all year round. Anybody can go there. Lots of different flights, different times. And of course, at this time of year, it might make you feel better to know that it rained the entire time I was there this time.
It does make me feel better. Thanks,
so,
Sarah.
You know, but it does mean that people can go at a more affordable time of year. Mm-hmm. Without doubt, it's an expensive destination.
It is. Let's talk Europe. As I said, experiencing significant heat waves. How are you seeing these extreme temperatures affect travel plans and destinations this summer?
Well, currently, to be honest, I've spoken to a few of my colleagues about this. We're not really finding people wanting to cancel or change destinations as yet. As things develop, that might become what we're looking at. I know that last year, Rhodes, for example, saw a lot of people having been displaced. Mm-hmm. And so that's not really high on anybody's agenda so far this year. But to be honest, Europe as a whole, we've seen a little bit of slower traffic. It's always typically been the best place to go in the summer months because it's got the best climate. But it's also, because of that demand, it's also seen some of the highest flight prices. And people are now looking for a little bit of value for money that you can't necessarily get out of Europe.
That's
so with the exception of Greece.
So Greece still performing very well?
Greece is still performing very well. If you look at our stats from where we were booking for the summer months last year versus this year, Greece is still up there. It's just one of those destinations. There's so many different islands, so many places that you can go there that are different. So it's still high on people's agenda, particularly as Fly Dubai are going to a lot more destinations there.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when we're starting to plan our family holidays, that's Fly Dubai website that we go to start thinking about. Oh, and that's how we ended up going to Slovenia last year, actually, thinking Austria is really expensive. Switzerland, probably out the budget as well. But look, here's a nice alpine destination that's on Fly Dubai. And I have to say, if anyone's looking for a really amazing family holiday that was really good value, and I know we drew with them last night, get Slovenia on your list. Joining some travel counsellors, Sarah Pickford is with us. We are going to talk next. Does travel insurance protect you? Got a message here asking about most affordable destination for a family of four in August, not Europe. Miros is asking on 4001. And we've also had a message from someone calling himself Captain Sensible of Jumeirah. He's got some thoughts on navigating those high temperatures in Europe. Cancel their plans as such, but I do think it's going to be interesting, Sarah, to see how our decisions are swayed by climate change and, you know, over the next few years. You know, for example, we went to Portugal a few years ago and it was on fire. You know, we were driving through and saw charred trees and I was like, oh gosh, you know, I'm not sure this is going to be the travel destination, you know, in 10, 20 years' time. You know, do you think we are going to see more tourists looking at, you know, Northern Europe and looking at maybe heatwave safe destinations?
Absolutely. I mean, my mum lives on the Costa del Sol. So I've seen this change quite a lot over the last 20 years of her being there. And every summer, there's some level of fire. And I think, yeah, we're seeing quite a shift towards a lot of the Scandinavian countries now. And yeah, as we were talking about in the break, you know, I personally look for cold holidays sometimes because trying to escape the heat here in the summer, there's no point in going somewhere else that's going to be equally as bad.
Well, we're going to the Netherlands and I've had a few friends going, oh, it's going to rain, mind. I'm like, I don't really mind because it's not like I'm coming from, you know, Newcastle, where I'm from in the UK, and a 2-week holiday is my only chance to get some sun. You know, we're lucky enough here that in, you know, many, many of the months, you know, we can go to the beach and, you know, get a bit of a tan if that's what you want to do. It's not this kind of, we need to escape the doom and gloom with 2 weeks in Lanzarote. You know, it's a very different mindset. So bring on the rain, I say. I'll pack my waterproof. I've had a message here from a man describing himself as Captain Sensible of Jumeirah, saying, my wife and I, kids aged 7 and 9, are spending 3 weeks in mainland Europe, a week in the Dordogne in France and 2 weeks in Greece, splitting our time between Kefalonia and Zakynthos. Am I saying that right?
Yes, you are.
Excellent. We have not considered changing our plans in light of the heat wave. Spent 2 weeks in Greece last year, had a wonderful time. Areas were not affected by the terrible fires and we were constantly reminded to act sensibly given the hot weather conditions. When holidaying in areas that are experiencing extreme heat, it's important to adjust behaviours accordingly. Seek shade during the midday heat, drink plenty of water, sunscreen, hats, etc. We would not go and sit on the beach here in Dubai at the moment. So why do that and expose yourself to extreme heat when on holiday? Thank you, Captain Sensible. Absolutely right. But I think, as I said, if that's your two weeks of sun, then you're like, I'll just pop out. Message here from Miras for you, Sarah, what is the most affordable destination for a family of four in August, in brackets, not Europe?
That will really depend on what kind of a holiday you're looking for. Anywhere that's not high season, really. So I'd say probably Thailand, going over to Thailand, because it's likely to be a little bit wetter than some other destinations. But of course, it depends on where you go in Thailand. If you go to the popular hotspots of, you know, Phuket or Krabi, then you're going to be finding prices are higher because the demand is there more. You know, it's similar. We see a lot of people going to Indonesia. They go to Bali, but there are a lot of other islands. I know Fly Dubai has got flights now into Langkawi and Penang in Malaysia, a nice alternative that people maybe don't think about. And also sometimes it's just planning differently. I'm not here to advocate taking kids out of school, but without doubt...
that was the conversation we had yesterday.
Without doubt, as soon as the schools finish, everybody's off and that's when the flight prices are at the highest. So if you can manipulate holidays a little bit and travel a little bit before everybody else and come back a bit earlier than everybody else, that's when, you know, are the bargains to be had in the summer months last minute? Not really, because you're getting what is left rather than what you would want and what you might plan for a year in advance. But there are ways of tweaking it, and that is definitely being flexible with A, your travel day and the destination.
What about, do you get people coming to you saying, you know, I want to fly to, let's say, Bali, but I want a direct route and, you know, obviously it's going to be more cost effective if you stop off. I know that. I know sensibly that that makes sense, but I'm not going to do it. I hate going through transit with kids and bags, and I'd rather pay the extra money because that's what's valuable to me. You know, the convenience of sitting on a plane for 7 hours is much preferable than, you know, saving 500 dirhams. So what are you hearing from clients?
I feel exactly the same as you. I'm a convenience traveller. I want to go directly. As I mentioned, my mum's on the Costa del Sol. We don't have direct flights into Malaga. It's a really difficult journey back for me. But yes, definitely because of costs. You know, I'm finding families of four that maybe are from the UK originally and want to go back to see their families. The cost of four economy flights to the UK is double maybe with Emirates than it was 6 years ago. So they not can't necessarily afford that. So they are maybe looking to go through, you know, you mentioned Holland, maybe go with KLM, mm-hmm. Or taking stopovers, go to Greece, go via Athens to get home. I think the difficulty comes where you're mixing airlines. That bumps the price up again because you can't go indirect to get back and then come back directly because you're having one-way tickets. Mm-hmm. But yes, people are definitely looking to be a little bit more creative. And, you know, I and my colleagues are looking to be a lot more creative on behalf of our clients. You know, when you're talking to a travel counsellor, what's important to us is getting it right for you, and that includes your budget. Mm-hmm. So if you tell me you want to go somewhere and your budget is 20,000 and I already know that a direct flight is going to cost you that much, we need to look at an alternative for you.
Some suggestions coming in. I don't know if this is directed to Miras in particular, who's looking for an affordable destination, but some great ideas. South Africa. Cape Town is in winter now. It's so on my list. I'm desperate to go to South Africa. I really, really am. And a no message on saying Mexico. I'm going for the whole month. Perfect weather, great food, lots to do. Oh, I'm getting jealous now. Have you made any summer plans for yourself, Sarah?
I'm sadly not able to leave for a long period like a lot of people. Not sadly, I've got cats, so I need to be at home for them. But yeah, I'm travelling quite a bit. I've just come back from the Maldives. I'm actually going again in a couple of weeks.
Oh, get out.
I'm going on a yacht cruise around Italy. So yeah, I've got a few different things going on this summer.
You have to though, don't you? How can you talk about destinations unless you've been there? We've got a couple of messages on the voice notes as well. This is a fellow travel counsellor, Angela Sharp, giving her take on Europe and trends.
Hi, Helen. In terms of summer travel for this year, I actually haven't seen any changes as of yet. I think for a lot of people, it's so hot here. They're just pleased to escape the humidity, especially. As alternatives, though, we always see lots of people heading east towards Sri Lanka, Southeast Asia. Obviously, it offers great value for money, avoids any Schengen visa issues. Of course, you're still likely to face the odd tropical storm here or there. But, you know, that's a nice relief from here. We do also see people looking for a mix of beach for relaxation and city breaks for culture and history. These seem to be becoming more and more popular, especially where there's more multi-generational holidays, people meeting grandparents, those that are not heading, choosing to not head back to their home country for the summer, for example.
Angela Sharp there. We were just talking earlier with Sarah Pickford about kids coming out of school early. So this is actually a clip from Karina, who got in touch yesterday on this topic.
It's cheaper to fly by before end of term, definitely cheaper. I actually send the kids, they are old enough to travel on their own, being 14 and 16 almost a few days back. And yes, it was, let's say, around 1,000 dirhams cheaper for two tickets. So it's definitely working. Plus, you avoid all the craziness in the airport once the school is over.
There you go. So, Sarah, we mentioned Greece there, mentioned the Maldives. Where do you think we're going to be seeing in the next kind of 5 years really exploding on the destination front? If you got your Mystic Meg crystal ball out?
Well, it does depend on where you're from originally. You know, there's just been a conversation about South Africa. It is an amazing destination. So anybody that lives here, we've got a direct flight to South Africa. So that's definitely going to take off. The currency makes it a very good value option for us. I think the Philippines as well. We have a lot of Filipino friends here, don't we? And would like to explore their country. I know I have customers who've had Filipino helpers and they go over to see them. So it's meeting family, which is lovely. Mm-hmm. I think Turkey is also very much on the rise. We have direct flights now from Fly Dubai. And I think really just looking at where the airlines are going, you know, we've got Wizz Air now in Abu Dhabi.
I haven't tried it yet, have you?
I have done it. I did it back from Vienna last Christmas. I think it was last Christmas. And, you know, you get what you pay for. It's a, you know, it's a good airline. You're not expecting any frills. It gets you to where you want to be. And it's a fraction of the price of the national carriers. Mm-hmm. So if we look at to see what kind of trends and where they're going, that's where we'll see the big impact. Similarly with Air Arabia from Sharjah. If you're flexible with where you can go from, the world opens up a little bit at an affordable cost.
And sometimes you just need someone to tell you what's what. So Sarah, with your permission, if people want to send me the word travel or a plane emoji, can I share your details? Would that be okay?
That would be great.
Your eye health on eye.
With Moorfields Eye Hospital Dubai. Eye care for you and your children. Moorfields, driven by your vision.
Talking eye health now with Dr. Saher, consultant ophthalmologist at Moorfields Eye Hospital. And we're talking about dry eyes in particular. Dr. Saher, how are you?
Hello, very well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. I know how busy you guys are, but I think this is a really important one, especially when we look at kind of seasonality, you know, air quality, time being spent on planes, and how it all kind of contributes to this idea of dry eye. I've also had a couple of messages unrelated to dry eye, but I'm hoping you can help today. Can you explain in maybe non-doctorly terms for the rest of us, what exactly are dry eyes and how common is this?
Yeah, so dry eye is quite common, especially in warm climates such as we have here. So it's a condition where, you know, we start to feel burny sensation. Sometimes our eyes water a lot, which, you know, some people think, oh, if my eyes are dry, how come they're watering? Mm. But it's because they're dry, we have a reflex of tear production, which is in excess of what we need. But it's not the healthy tears, let's say, which we should normally produce. So people feel very irritated, they can't keep their eyes open, they're light sensitive, and, you know, feeling uncomfortable, heavy eyelids in general. So these are the symptoms. It comes from, you know, a variety of causes, but mostly, and let's say the most common, is because of our environment where we live in, and also factors related to our eyelids and how healthy they are, which causes our tears to evaporate quicker than usual. Yeah.
Of course. So you say it makes sense, but it's never really occurred to me. So environmental factors, so heat. What about humidity? Yeah. How do they contribute to development of dry eyes, Doctor? Yeah.
So like if we're in an environment where it's humid, also, you know, everything kind of sticks. Our eyelids become very sticky. The surface, we have on the surface of the eyelids openings which secrete lipids or oily secretion. It's part of the tears, but they get clogged up. So that actually oil, it kind of acts as a surface layer to stop the evaporation quicker. So when that's not produced properly, the tears evaporate quicker. So all this contributes to our symptoms of dryness. So therefore, in order to kind of remedy it and make it better, we need to take care of our eyelids, our eyelid health, do like some warm compresses daily, clean the lid margins, and that helps to keep the eyelids healthy. And in addition,
I know this is obviously your area of expertise. I don't know a single, I've never heard the phrase eyelid health before. It doesn't it didn't even cross my mind. I'm like, oh, it's just another thing I'm not doing. So warm compresses could be really beneficial.
Sure. So if we like get a clean face cloth, soak it in warm water, place it over our closed eye for about 5 minutes, and we do like massaging afterwards while we kind of press on the eyelids from top to bottom on the upper lid and bottom to top on the lower lid, that kind of the heat actually helps all this dry oil to kind of soften, and the massage helps to express it, and it kind of clears up these blocked glands, which we have sometimes on the eyelids. It also soothes and makes you more comfortable, actually. So,
that's the prevention. What about treatment? You know, when we're looking at treatment, is that something that someone will have to do for the rest of their life, or, you know, can it just be circumstantial?
Sure. So it is. This is actually also a treatment and a prevention. Right. So it's a kind of a daily routine that we can do as, let's say, as patients to do that for ourselves. In addition to that, we can obviously, when we see the doctor, they'll prescribe some lubricant eye drops. These help to moisturize the surface of the eye and help to soothe it and make it feel more comfortable. And things which also we have to kind of consider is our lifestyle modification. Let's say we're on screens. Most of us are on screens with our jobs and everything. If it's not laptop, it's our mobile phones. So staring on a screen for a long time, you forget to blink. So always remember to blink, like take a break every 20 minutes. Take a break, 5-10 minutes, relax your eyes, blink a few times, you know, even like every 10 minutes, you know, just remember to blink more.
I'm now blinking like a maniac in the studio because when you think about it, it's all you can do.
Sorry,
go on, doctor.
So obviously drinking a lot of water, keep your body hydrated, because if your body is dry, your eyes dry up as well. So we often forget to drink water as well. So what we're doing, we're sitting in our indoor environments are cooled from the AC, which is on all the time, and it's blowing on our face the air, which even makes our tears evaporate quicker. And at the same time, we feel less thirsty. We're not drinking water, so our bodies are dry and our eyes become dry as well. So lots of things adding, you know, to our condition and making things worse. But they can easily be remedied if we think about it and just take the, you know, simple steps to help us.
Quick fire questions for you, Dr. Seher. And before we get to that, sure, though, we've been talking about dry eye. I wanted to ask you, are you seeing this in kids? We talked earlier about the relationship between the condition and screen time. And if my kids are anything to go by, they should be having some dry eye. Are you seeing a rise in clinic?
Dry eyes can happen for adults and children alike. So because it's the same environment, they're also using so much screens, forgetting to drink water. So it's quite common in both, you know. It's important to the measures we take for all of us.
Be aware. Okay, to the text line we go. Shireen's been in touch saying, my daughter is using blue eye drops to make the whites of eyes look brighter. Are they safe to use every day? She's 18.
Yeah, so blue eye drops are lubricant eye drops. So yes, using lubricants daily is safe, and they help actually to keep our eyes comfortable and keep them lubricated. So I would always say try and get an eye drop which doesn't have any preservatives. It's always good because sometimes some people have some sensitivity to preservatives. Mm-hmm. So just check when you're buying some eye drops or lubricants off the counter, check if they have preservatives or not. Those that don't have preservatives, we can use them more often than the ones that are preserved.
Fab. Hope that helps, Shireen. And Stuart's saying, I've been wearing contacts for about 8 years now, daily disposable. They're fine for a while, but in the last few years, been increasingly suffering with dry eyes. I do use drops, but they only offer temporary relief, and the ones recommended are really expensive. Do you have any recommendations for contact lenses that help with dry eyes, or drops that really do help? Is this common with contact lens users, and what does Stuart need to know?
Yeah, so using contact lenses actually can aggravate your symptoms if you have dry eyes already. So that's why it's important to use lubricants before you put them in, and also while you have them in. So just because you've got a contact lens in, it doesn't mean you can't use the lubricants while you have it in. Go for the non-preserved eye drops. They come in like single dose units, small tiny bottles, a packet of tiny bottles. These are helpful, and you can use them quite often, because when we have when we're using contact lens, it actually the surface of the eye becomes even more drier. So that's why you start to feel uncomfortable. So just use a lot of lubrication. Right. Most contact lenses actually, the newer ones in the market, they have, let's say, better comfort. So go for the big well-known brands. Don't buy any just contact lens from anywhere. Go to a proper optical shop or to the eye hospital, and they would recommend the ones for you.
Yeah, Welcome aboard, listeners. Today we are navigating the friendly skies with an etiquette aficionado. Joining us from Berkeley Etiquette, we've got Zing Zhu talking about the ins and outs of in-flight etiquette. According to a recent YouGov article, airline travel can feel like a bit of a comedy of manners, debates over seat reclining, personal space, do's and don'ts of interacting with flight attendants. So you're with us as we uncover some, the realities of our fellow passengers. So we're going to be giving you some do's and don'ts, but I want to hear from you. What drives you absolutely insane when you're on a plane? 4001. Welcome to the show. I'm so happy you're here. How are you?
Thank you so much, Helen. Honoured to be here.
Now, before we start talking travel and, you know, really start having a bit of a moan, because I'm English, love a moan, tell us a little bit about your background. Why did you feel like etiquette was an area that you wanted to specialise in? And what are some of the common questions, comments, challenges that people are coming to you with, Zing?
Yeah, thank you so much. So I was in the banking world for over 10 years, so 6 years in the UK, 5 years in Dubai. And I've noticed how important etiquette is. If you look at people who are at the top of the ladder in the corporate world, they're rarely the people that are only good at technical skills. Mm. They're very good at communicating well, carrying themselves well, and making other people feel comfortable around them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's really important. I personally learned a lot. So I really wanted to use what I learned in the banking world, and also went to a Swiss finishing school, to combine those two part very traditional etiquette with modern day practice into something really powerful to make people become better and make this world a better place.
I want to know more about the Swiss finishing school.
Oh gosh.
What was it like?
Actually, it's my 2 year anniversary.
Graduation.
Oh, thank you.
Happy
yes.
graduation.
It's really dreamy. So finishing school, a lot of people think it's really old school. You mm-hmm. think you would walk with a book on top of your head.
Yes.
They're actually evolved in modern days. In the modern world, there's only one proper traditional finishing school left in Switzerland. So you would go there, you stay in the house, you arrange flowers, you arrange the table, you iron the napkin, iron the tablecloth, and you learn body language, you learn how to descend the stairs, you learn culture from across 50 different cultures.
Wow.
It's an incredible experience.
Wow. We're talking travel today.
Yeah.
Before we delve into the survey, I wanted to know, and you work between Dubai and London, so spending some time in the air, what drives you insane?
Way too many things.
Yeah, come on.
Where do I even start? Okay, so I think one of the biggest things is reclining seat, right? It's absolutely fine to recline your seat, but you need to be very mindful of the person behind you. Do they have some food on their table, or what are they up to? So, because etiquette is all about making other people feel comfortable around you. Mm-hmm. And also what I want people to really remember is that you're not just representing yourself. You're actually representing your culture. So when we do certain things, people will be thinking, okay, people from that culture is rude. So reclining seat, and of course, imagine that it's a very close space and you're trapped there with strangers for many hours. So it's quite a vulnerable space. You want to be very mindful of things that could have a lot of strong smell.
So, right. I'm laughing because I got a flight last week. I hope he's not listening. I was with my friend James, who met me at the gate with three sandwiches. He's a big guy. You know, one airplane meal is not going to fuel that furnace. Oh. The sandwiches were, are you ready? Number one, egg. Number two, tuna.
Oh,
and then
goodness.
A nice warm pastrami baguette for dessert. I was like, oh, James, you are lucky.
Goodness.
I love you. I know. It really, yeah. So I hate it when people bring food, like hot food onto planes. And they're there with, like, you know, a bucket of chicken or, you know, like a Happy Meal. I'm like, oh, it really, really annoys me. So food smells, with you 100%. I just said to you off air, I don't want to see your armpits. I do not want to see your toes.
Yeah.
Keep absolutely. Your socks and shoes on.
Yeah.
Lots of messages coming in on this. We're going to be delving into the survey in just a few minutes, which was talking about what is the number one kind of bugbear in air. Let me know yours. We need to start an airline where we just have a bit more quality control. Recent survey, and this was done out of the US, by the way, 80% of Americans agree it is unacceptable for commercial airline passengers to do the following. Let their children play in the aisle is number one. Drinking too much, leaving their seat during turbulence, watching a movie or show without headphones. Some really interesting pet peeves. We've just been talking about eating strong smelling food, exiting the plane before the people in the row in front of them. Oh, I have to say, I agree with you on that. From Berkeley Etiquette Today, we have got Ziying Zhu sharing her insights as an etiquette expert and loving your messages too. Mohammed, you're on the line. Tell us, what is your number one rant about your fellow passengers?
Hi there, Helen.
Hi.
So one of the things that I really hate, which will happen to me, is that when it's a late night flight and everyone's sleeping on the plane, it's pitch dark, and there's this passenger on my side who has his headlight turned on reading his book.
Yes.
And even if I have my iPads on, then the light just gets in and you could never sleep the whole night.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. Maybe we need to start carrying those little clip-on lights for books that they could use. Selfishness, I think, is probably summarised there quite nicely. Mohammed, thank you so much. I'm with you. Okay. I would sign that petition. Sarah saying, travel rant. I don't want to hear your FaceTime call with your family or your choice of film. Wear headphones. Yes. Are you seeing more and more of this?
Oh, I was actually a victim of this just a few weeks ago. I was on a short flight to Rome from London, and there's a gentleman and his son watching cartoon together with no headphones and laughing themselves out loud all the time.
Cocomelon, put it away. We don't want to hear wheels on the bus from your three-year-old. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your take on this survey.
Sure.
So what would you... How do you... Okay. The flight attendant thing, I think, is an interesting one. A lot of people had kind of strong feelings about chatting with strangers and chatting with flight attendants. How do you feel about someone striking up a conversation if they're sitting next to you on the plane? And then we'll get onto flight attendants.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I noticed in that survey that actually more people think is okay to chat with a stranger for the whole flight than the people who think is unacceptable.
The whole flight?
Yes. Look at that survey.
I would say a polite... I don't think he's going to be listening. I had a shocker a few years ago, an absolute shocker. This guy was kind of started talking to me at the gate. And I was polite, but wasn't encouraging, shall we say. And guess who was sitting next to me on the plane and kept on wanting to talk to me to the point where at one point he took his finger and put it on my screen to turn down the volume of what I was watching to get my attention. I nearly lost my mind. Did I? No. I kind of tried to shut him down. My husband also had one where a child was kicking the back of his seat repeatedly.
Yeah, yeah.
And he turned around and made stern eye contact with both child and parent, to which the mother replied, "You're in his kick zone."
Oh my goodness. People just don't realize what their behavior would impact other people, right? Obviously, this eye contact thing, this is what I do. Sometimes they will get it. But if they don't, then you have to go to someone with authority. In this case, a flight attendant. Mm-hmm. You don't have to say it when they're there. You make it very subtle. You go to speak to a flight attendant in the back, and then they will come back maybe a few minutes later, so it's not so obvious. And hopefully they will get it.
Can we open this out to maybe some etiquette over the summer? I think a lot of people going to weddings over the summer. I wanted to ask you about being a good guest. Mm-hmm. From getting the invitation to after you leave the event, what's the gold standard?
Or for a wedding or a party.
A party or a wedding, something that's a special occasion that people might be going to over
the course. Summer. I think there are many things that could be an entire program if I want to talk all about it. But I think one of the first things you want to consider is to RSVP in time. So you want to be very mindful so that people could consider you in. And if you have a plus one, you want to let them know in advance. The last thing you want to do is, oh, by the way, I'm bringing two people just the day before the event. And also, I always say to people, you never want to show up empty-handed, whatever party, weddings that you go to. And you want to be a gracious guest, be very considerate to what the host occasion is about. And send your best wishes, your best behavior. Don't get too drunk.
What about thank you notes?
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I always had a notebook, you know, at Christmas and birthdays to make a note. And that was like a big part of, you know, after special occasions, sitting writing thank you notes. And when my kids get presents now, we don't send a thank you letter because convenience, but we would send, you know, a picture of them with that, a voice note from the child, you know, a WhatsApp most likely.
Yeah.
Do you think that's kind of norm now?
So thank you note is actually quite a big thing in the etiquette world. We all think that is something that should still stay in the modern world that we're in today. If someone does something really nice to you, someone could go out of their way, we always want to write something on paper and send it to them. That's something very meaningful.
So how do you think social media has changed the way we interact with each other in real life?
Social media is a double-edged sword, isn't it? There are many things out there. People think, oh, I'm hiding behind my phone screen, you don't know who I am, so therefore I can say whatever I want, mm-hmm. whenever I want to, whoever I want to. But the reality is the people who are not so kind online, a lot of the times they're hurting inside. And what I want people to think is that if you don't say that in person to that someone, to their face, why should you do that online, right?
It's an interesting thing as we look at children and teens who are growing up socializing an yeah. awful lot on social media, because, you know, when we didn't have these interactions, you were kind of forced to mm. have maybe an uncomfortable conversation, to, you know, resolve a conflict in real life. Mm. And what I'm hearing from parents, especially those with teenagers, it's, oh, that people just get kicked out of a WhatsApp group, or there's an idea of kind of humiliation on social media and bullying. And we're losing the ability to have difficult conversations because we just remove, delete, mute, archive.
I really think social media should not be used way too much, because it's actually doing a lot of bad than good. Mm. It's one of the number one sources of depression at the moment.
So it's something I'm really worried about with my children.
I really do.
We're going to run out of time, but I wanted to ask you, what are you working on right now? When clients come to you, whether it is an individual or a business, what are the big pain points or pitfalls in 2024 when it comes to etiquette?
Of course. So there are many different scenarios, the reason why people come to me. I'll give some examples. There are some people that are just really good at their technical skills. They excelled at university and at their work for the first, let's say, 5 to 10 years, and they get promoted, or they don't get promoted to the job they want to.
Maybe plateau a bit.
Yeah, and then they just get hit a ceiling and they don't know how to move forward. Mm-hmm. So they need to work on the way that they carry themselves, they communicate, and to build their personal brand on their confidence as well. And that's when I come in, because actually 80% of our success comes from soft skills, not technical skills, and yet we're never taught.
It's so interesting, and it's something I'm thinking an awful lot, you know, with children as well, that you can have incredible academic success and you can go to an amazing university and your resume could be impeccable. But if you're not likable yeah. or you're not personable, you've got to think, you know, is this someone that I want to be around for 8, 9, 10 hours a day in the workplace? Is this someone that I would want to have around, you know, an office desk or, you know, a coffee, or dinner table? Because results and accolades can open a door, but, you know, to stay in the room, it needs to be so much more than that. And I think that's a really interesting stat in terms of 80% on those soft skills. We have run out of time. Can I ask you then, Ziying, with your permission, if people want to send me the word, what word should we have? Let's have thrive as a word. If you want to send me the word thrive, I will send you the details of Berkeley Etiquette so you can find out more. Great resource online as well. Some great advice, tips and tricks. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate
it. Thank you.
I'm hoping that gets me off sending you a thank you note, because my penmanship is appalling. Great to have you with us this Wednesday afternoon. A very special guest joining us. Emma Edwards is the brilliant mind behind The Broke Generation, certified financial behavioural specialist, and on a mission to help people understand the psychology behind their financial behaviours and ultimately transform their relationship with money and maybe themselves too. From tackling no-spend challenges to navigating the influence of social media on our spending habits, she has got a wealth of knowledge, practical tips to share as well. So we're diving right in to talk about how we can take control of our finances and ultimately lead a more fulfilling life. Emma, thank you for joining us. And you're speaking to us from Australia, so thank you for the time difference as well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And I've been following you on Instagram for a while. You've got, you know, nearly 100,000 followers. Your content is so engaging and accessible. And I wanted to find out a little bit more about you, if you wouldn't mind, for anyone that's not familiar with, you know, your work on The Broke Generation. What inspired you to start this? Was there a personal story or a moment or a bill that perhaps sparked a bit of self-reflection and thought, actually, more people need to be having some honest conversations about their money?
Yeah, so it did stem from a personal journey. I'd always been quote unquote bad with money. I felt like I was bad with money. It was sort of an identity I just kind of absorbed. You know, some people were good with money and I was jealous of that. And some people were bad with money and I was one of those people. And by that, I really just meant, you know, I didn't have loads of savings. If my tire went flat, it was always stressful. I didn't have much of a sort of structure for my money. I sort of had friends that would there's a story I tell in my book, and I had a friend, and we both worked at the same cafe, and we both had a second job as well, and she had like two bank accounts, and she saved all the money from one of her jobs, and I was just like mind blown at how, not only how she did that behaviorally, but like how she had the foresight and the understanding of the role of money in life to know that that was a worthwhile thing to do. You know, the older you get, you kind of go, God, I've been made redundant. I wish I had.
Yeah, I wish I'd started saving when I was, you know, 18, yeah. 20.
But when I just never had that, you know, I just never had that instinct to reserve a surplus of money for the future. I just, money came to me and it just, I would try, but it would just leak out of my life, and I'd scribble these budgets on the back of a napkin and go, right, okay, well, that's going to come in from there, and then I'll have £50, because I was living in the UK at the time, £50 for the rest of the month, and it's like the fourth of the month, never going to work. But I'd set myself up for failure, and it would just be this cycle of just avoidance and just a bit of chaos, really.
So at what point did you make that decision to educate yourself to, because I always think about, you know, New Year's resolutions, that we expect that on the stroke of midnight we're going to be a whole new person, and our spending habits are going to change, our willpower is going to go through the roof, we won't have an appetite, you know, we have these really unrealistic expectations where we're ultimately the same person as we were, you know, 10 minutes ago. So for you, how did you do that gradually without kind of, you know, freaking yourself out and ultimately going back into that spiral of spending to make yourself feel better, you know, punishing yourself and having this limiting belief that you were bad with money?
It's, people ask me this question a lot, and I've sort of reflected on it a lot in hindsight, because when things are happening, you don't necessarily have that, I guess, top-down view of like, what is it that I'm doing differently this time? And looking back and kind of combining it with, I guess, my understanding of financial psychology and behavior now, there's a trans-theoretical model of behavior change that talks about an individual's readiness to change. And there's a number of phases that you go through before the change actually starts to happen. And then relapse is actually part of that same process. And you might relapse and then kind of jump back into the cycle again with, you know, knowledge that you've gained on the way. And I really think that that is what happened for me. So I moved to Australia to be with my partner, who is Aussie. And we had to pay about $7,000 or $8,000, so about £4,000 or £5,000 for my visa. And that was the first time I'd ever made any progress with saving, because it was literally save this money or get deported.
It was
and
tangible.
I was like, yeah. And it was, there was no
very
real
motivating. Yeah.
Very motivating. So I did that, and we paid it. And, you know, we were on very low incomes at the time, so it was tight. And my husband was still studying and this and that. But we managed to pay it. And what I noticed, I was like, wow, that's the first time I've ever done that in my life, and like saved up that money and then had something there. But I did kind of default back to my old habits once that deadline was gone. But I had learned savings behaviors along the way. And I think what was really happening was I then got to this point where sort of friends of mine started buying houses, and I was like, oh my God,
you're grown-ups.
Yeah. How also, have we been saving house deposits?
Also, and but isn't it funny how people don't tell you what they're doing as well? You're like, well, no one told me we were supposed to be doing that. Well, how did you get away with that? Am I the mug here?
You know? Yes. I really felt like that. I always describe it as that scene in Sex and the City when Carrie Bradshaw loses all her work on her laptop and she goes, when were we all backing up our work? That's how I felt about money. When were we all saving? I thought we were all just a mess together. So I think that those sort of a few moments like that, and a few kind of, you know, I definitely set new goals and sort of tried new things. But there was this sort of moment where I really decided to show up for what I was trying to change every day. You mentioned before, you know, we make these big promises but about all these things we're going to change. I think through going through those process of being more and more ready to actually understand that it wasn't a case of going, I'm going to save 10 grand and just magically being able to do it. I think I was able to get the clarity of thought to understand that it wasn't a case of sitting down, setting a budget or setting a goal and then living my life as normal. I had to go, right, what am I, if I'm going to save that money, if I'm going to be a saver, if I'm going to build up savings, I need to be the type of person that doesn't crawl to payday with £3 in my account, which means step it back again.
Or worse, into the overdraft of the credit card. Yeah.
Again, I need to be the type of person that doesn't go, oh, I've got $100 spare in my overdraft, that means I can buy something. I had to meet that resistance and you know, very slowly it started with really small things like challenging myself. I've got a brain that kind of works with like very concentrated periods of focus. I love a challenge. I love to try something. And so I would, you know, give myself a challenge to live on like 20 pounds that week and do like a really lean food shop and go, oh, if I do that, there's money left. And it's not that you live like that all the time.
No, of course not. I mean, some people do, but that's how we learn, isn't it? Go, this is possible. It's within my control, which is a pretty empowering thing when you feel like money's been ruling you. Far more control than you might realise. I wanted to ask you, I mean, we were talking just then about you making these, well, kind of revelations and changes. A bit later on, really. But many of us have got a complicated relationship with money, and sometimes it starts far, far earlier. Given the work that you have done now as a certified financial behaviour specialist, Emma, can you explain how our psychology and early experiences perhaps shape some of our financial behaviours too?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of attention on our financial reality when we grow up. You know, if you grew up rich, you'll be rich. If you grow up poor, you know, it's a different outcome. But what we often neglect is the way that we experience money. Mm. And so that really comes down to, you know, these, our core money memories form by the age of 7. And that is sort of the things that we might have witnessed with money, the way that money might have been talked about, the way that we experienced it, rather than the factual numbers. Mm-hmm. Of course, the factual numbers sometimes influence the experience if there is capacity or there isn't. But you see this a lot with siblings. There might be two siblings that grew up in the exact same household with the exact same financial capacity. They did or didn't have the PlayStation. They did or didn't have pocket money. But one of them goes on to be a great saver, or maybe even a bit toxically saver oriented. And the other one will go on and be a big spender. And
it's so funny you say that, because my daughters are 7 and 9 and they've just started getting pocket money in the last kind of year or so. One of them reminds me a lot of my brother. Like, I don't want to say tight, but tight with money. My brother would have his Easter egg in June and was younger than me, and I was always borrowing money from him. And she's like that. Like, she likes to see the numbers add up in her account. The younger one, I mean, keep her out of Claire's accessories. She'll buy any old sequined tat. Like, it's like money burns a hole in the pocket. It's really interesting to kind of see it. Because, again, we use very similar language about money around them. You know, we talk about it's a looking day, not a buying day. Or if we buy this, we need to, you know, we're kind of pretty, I hope, savvy about it. But, yeah, it's just personality and how it exhibits through cash. But what about education, Emma? You know, you say in your book, Good With Money, that it was written for women who were taught more about cellulite than managing money. So why is this such a common problem? Let's talk about women in particular, even millennial women, I think, which is kind of your wheelhouse. What was missing and what do you think is still missing when it comes to financial education?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different landscape now for younger women because we do have access to the internet and social media, and money is being talked about a lot more. But, you know, I'm 33, so I'm like textbook millennial. And you look back at, and I grew up with a single mum, you look back at the things that we were taught, and all I've been on a diet since I was probably 10. I could tell you more about the difference between Weight Watchers points and Slimming World Sins and Atkins bars and all that kind of stuff than I could about investments for a really long time. And there's a lot of commentary around, you know, that you see the side by side of the magazines of women are told to save money and cut coupons and men are told to invest. And that is a critical difference. But I think the layer beneath that is not only were we not taught to be financially savvy and be financially independent and confident, and as well, the legislation did not allow us to be in many countries for a long time. It's also what we were being taught. And we were being taught that being a size 12 was fat. We were being taught that 1,200 calories was an appropriate amount to eat. We were being taught that being thin was the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And the things that you are focusing on will not only also be the things that you are spending on, but there's also an understanding, I suppose, of your role in the world. And if you don't understand yourself as somebody who is financially independent, financially confident, financially autonomous, but you understand yourself as, you know, a cog in the diet culture machine, and your constant goal every single New Year's is not to get financially confident, it is to lose 10 pounds. Mm-hmm. it really starts to make a lot more sense.
It does. There's been a lot on social recently about, you know, let's keep women skinny so they're too tired to do anything else. Which,
yeah, and I mean, that comes into it as well.
It definitely does.
You know, women couldn't own houses or have bank accounts on their own until alarmingly late, in like the 70s and 80s. Mm. But even when we could have them, we didn't have the, I guess, cultural proximity, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think a lot of women still feel, even if they are in an equal loving marriage, that they don't deserve a space at the table really to talk about some of those big financial decisions about where are we investing? What are our financial goals? This is my opinion, you know, and I think that's a lot of it to do is, I think, a lot to do with jargon and feeling excluded from the conversation. But this is something that other people do. This is a male conversation. This is, you know, that's not for me. And I think there are some people doing amazing, amazing things around this idea of re-education and reframing. But it's such a conscious choice, and it's not an easy choice. It's not an easy choice to say, I'm going to listen to podcasts such as yours and read your book, or, you know, really engage in the conversation and talk to my friends about it. You know, if we go out for dinner, be like, oh, you know, what's working for you? What's not working for you? What are your common challenges? Because we don't actually at all.
We don't. And that view of that taboo often can come from how taboo it was growing up as well, or if money caused conflict, or if money, particularly if maybe you were, you had maybe less financial capacity than people around you, or than the area that you lived in, or if you were the lower socioeconomic status compared to people at your school, or your parents versus other parents and things like that. Often there can be a bit of almost a performance that everything's okay. And that means all the challenges just go unspoken, and we think we're alone when we're experiencing them, but we're not.
Emma, I saw a quote on your Instagram which says, you save a lot of money when you like yourself. Can you expand on that for us?
Yes. This is something that I've been working with in a group program that I run for women that want to kind of break up the consumption cycle with clothing, because clothing is so deeply tied to our identity and our self-concept. And this kind of speaks to the amount of stuff, and again, this is that other duality between what women weren't taught and what they were taught. The amount of stuff that I've spent money on and that women have spent money on in order to try and bridge this gap between the person we are and the person that we need to be. We've been kept in this state of almost, I call it the state of almost, for the majority of our adult lives, unfortunately. We're almost at our goal weight. We are almost stylish. We've almost cinched that waist enough. We've almost got rid of that cellulite, or we've almost, you know, tall enough, or almost nailed that style, but the trend cycle is going to move on again in 5 seconds.
And it extends to, you know, homes as well. You know, it's this identity of, this is who I want to present to the world. And yeah, I think about this a lot. You know, when I'm buying something, I'm like, is this for me? Is this a need, or is it, this is who I want to purport to be, whether it's in person or on social media? And I think you do a really great job on Instagram of kind of examining your motivations. There was one I saw which was, you know, before you buy something, ask, did I want this 3 years ago? Would I have wanted this historically? Why do you think that's a good reflection to have when we are in such a kind of fast-paced consumer world?
I think it's two-pronged. I think it comes down to one, that, you know, cycle of constantly buying things to fix yourself or to like yourself. Questioning whether you would have wanted this that time ago can kind of help you understand where you might be pursuing something that you've maybe been pursuing for a long time and have not achieved through consuming. But there's this other sort of more almost technological aspect, I suppose. When you look back to the way that we used to consume things even 10, 15 years ago, it's just so much more rapid now. There is so much more availability. There's so much more proximity. Mm-hmm. And trends move so quickly that, you know, we've seen it with like the resurgence of ballet pumps. Frankly, when I first saw them, I was like, please God, not again. But now through repeated exposure, I've thought, oh, I suppose they kind of work. But I've been like, no, because 3 years ago, I would have been repulsed, which means in 3 years' time, I won't want them, will have moved on to something else.
Isn't that interesting? Because I used to work in magazines, and I used to love magazines. I used to spend a fortune on magazines. And, you know, you'd see something and go, oh, I love that dress. And then it would be this kind of, not necessarily conscious cooling off period, but you couldn't buy it by clicking your finger on the page of a magazine. It'd be like, okay, you know, if I'm going shopping, I've got to get a method of transport into Newcastle, and then I've got to find the shop, and then they've got to have that dress, and they've got to have it in my size. And you might get it and try it on and go, actually, you know, I'd kind of romanticize this. Now, the way I consume media is through social media. And often it's a case of click the link in my stories, or click through immediately, you know, click to buy. And those friction points are just non-existent. And then you might arrive and you might try it on like you would in the shop and go, yeah, but I can't be bothered to send it back, can I?
Well, this is the thing. And it's just so, you know, with Apple Pay and Google Pay and all those kinds of things as well, you can literally tap, click and buy within seconds. And, you know, with buy now, pay later and things like that, you can even defer that payment as well. And there's just no time to really think about it. I notice it a lot because I grew up in a really small town and we didn't have most shops within even an hour's drive. So that was such a barrier that I just don't have now.
Yeah, it's scary.
It's just too easy.
Oh, up next, we are going to be talking about that no spend challenge. Emma Edwards is with us for today from The Broke Generation. We're also going to go to the text line. I've had a number of really interesting messages asking for some advice, but also sharing some tips too. We're talking money today. Helen Farmer with you in conversation with Emma Edwards. She is behind The Broke Generation. Huge on Instagram, podcasts, books. She's a certified financial behaviour specialist speaking to us Australia. And we're talking about no spend challenges, navigating the influence of social media we've just been addressing, and going to the messages too. I wanted to ask you about the no spend challenge. I did a no spend September a few years ago. And my kind of big takeaways were, I've got way too much in my wardrobe. I don't actually need anything. But coming back to the point before about why do I buy things? Why do I, you know, what am I distracting myself from? What's the rush I'm looking for, whether it's, you know, clicking and then getting the delivery? Tell us about, to your mind, the definition of a no-spend challenge and how you work with your followers and with people in the workshops to do it in a way that feels not like a punishment.
Yeah, so no spend challenges are really divisive, because on a behavioral level, I understand people's resistance, that it harks a little bit back to like a fad diet. You know, if you don't buy anything for a month, will you just rebound and go back to the way you were? There's a potential that that can happen. What I like to see no spend challenges as, firstly, I often like to do them in a certain category. So maybe we're really watching our food and drink spending this month, or we're really watching our discretionary material items spending this month. Mm-hmm. Just makes it a little bit more, I guess, lifestyle comfortable, so that you're able to focus on what it is that you're doing. But I like to see no spend challenges really as a concentrated period of focus. I don't want you to shut your eyes, have a miserable month not spending anything, and then expect everything to be fixed at the end. It really is getting in the trenches moment of looking at where your money is going and identifying the pathways, I guess, that led you there, so that you can cut off the ones that aren't serving you. Often we can go through the month and spend, I don't know, £100, £200, £300 and feel like we've got nothing to show for it. And it might not be a case of not spending that £300. It might be a case of redeploying that money into something else. And so I like to sort of spend time with people. I do a lot of work with, as I've said, with women that want to change the way they're consuming clothing, because it is such a cycle and there is so much availability. And, you know, influencer and social media culture means that there is just this overconsumption. You know, look at landfill. We're buying far too many clothes, and it's not because we need to keep warm. It's because we're expressing ourselves. And in part, that is okay. But when you constantly buy things like clothes, but you never get to that state that you want to be at.
Almost.
When that motivation. When you never close that gap, when your expectations of who you are and who you're trying to be are constantly one step, constantly a step away from you, and you're constantly chasing it. Not only does it cost you a fortune and it's terrible for the environment, but it makes you feel horrible about yourself. Every time you try and be someone that you're not and you fail at being that person, you feel worse and worse and worse about yourself. And that makes you more and more and more susceptible to everything that is constantly sold to us. And it becomes this cycle.
It's hard.
So zooming in that no spend environment is really what the key is. It's not really about what you don't buy. It's about everything that you learn underneath that.
Can you share some strategies, Emma, for resisting the temptation to spend when we are constantly bombarded with ads, influencer promotions? We had a good message here from Cal saying, top tip, unsubscribe to all those emails you signed up for to get 10% off your first purchase. Also, disable your credit card from your phone. If you need to stand up and get your card, most of the time you won't. What else, other advice do you tend to share with your followers and people that sign up for the workshops for just being a bit more conscious about taking a pause? Let's not click. Is it unfollowing people? Can you know? Does it need to be that drastic sometimes?
Yeah, so I like to come at this from two angles, from the internal and from the external. So the external stuff is you're unsubscribing, you're unfollowing. Stellar tips to add barriers in to the purchase process. Yes, take Apple Pay off your phone, take your credit card off your phone, take any sort of saved details. You know, Google can sometimes save your details now. Get rid of that so that you're implementing barriers and look at the things externally that are maybe triggering you into that purchase process. Is it the people that you're following? Is it, you know, less so now that people work from home more, but I used to like walk through a shopping center to get to the train station. So I started going to a different train station because it meant, even if I wasn't buying, it meant that I had this awareness of what was in the windows of shops and that would start me off. So I started going a different way home so that I didn't have that exposure. Then I also look at it from the internal and really look at, and this is the harder part because it involves a lot of self-reflection, but really look at what am I trying to do? What are the emotions that are happening when I'm purchasing whatever it is that I'm purchasing? And often that a strategy I use for this is I get people to pick three things that they wish I could, you know, undo and get their money back for. And we do like a regret analysis and look back about how are we here now with this item in our possession and this money gone? Let's step it back. How did we get here? Was it a bad day and you wanted to treat yourself? Was it a wedding and you can't go to an event without buying something new? Was it, you know, a breakup? Was it you watched The Devil Wears Prada and got hopped up on that transformation culture that, you know,
what was the trigger? Who was the trigger? Interesting.
How did we get here?
I mean, I'm doing like a mental Rolodex, my wardrobe going, oh my God, so much regret. There's so many stories. I was so influenced.
So many. That can help us identify, you know, how we got there. And when we know that, I get people to use that information, and a sort of a tactic I use in the moment is I get people to go, when they see something, there's a common tip of wait 24 hours. I like to flip that and make it tell yourself that you will come back and buy this tomorrow, because you're tricking your brain into thinking you've gone, yeah, I see that you want that and you can have it. But chances are when the time has gone by, you won't. Mm-hmm. And that can be a good barrier.
I wanted to go to the text line. This actually came through on social media for you, Emma, earlier, saying, what if a couple has different spending habits and financial goals? I think it's easier when you're single, you're in charge of what's going in and out, but it's harder when it's joined and you are on different pages. That's from Lucy, and in brackets she said, and my overly generous husband. I've seen this with friends, when you go out for dinner and you're like, oh, interesting that you've decided to buy dinner for everyone, or interesting that the drinks are on you again, or, you know, we've spoken in the past about, you know, had guests on who are obsessed with clothes or trainers or holidays, or, I mean, it's Dubai, you know. We've got some really big outgoings here in terms of rent and schooling, but also things like cars. You know, like, do you really need to be driving that? When you know. So what if you are on a different page to your partner?
So much to say on this. It's often the forgotten part of couples' finances and the single versus couples debate. Mm-hmm. Couples are often, oh, it's easier for couples because there's two incomes. And in a capacity sense, yes, there is. But when it is just you, you're only dealing with your financial psychology, your behavioral glitches, your values. So when it comes down to couples, often a lot of couples' finances stuff focuses on what are we spending, where's it going. I always encourage people to go a level deeper and get really financially intimate with one another. Start with talking about what was money like for you in your household growing up, how have you experienced money throughout your life. You know, we talked earlier about those early memories. There are actually any major financial event throughout your life can kind of alter those beliefs or affirm them or dispute them. And sometimes just talking about that can help you make sense of why people are the way that they are. Sometimes people are really generous with their money because they grew up in a household where their family was so stingy and it was a point of shame. And now they find themselves making up for that. And having a conversation like that with someone that you feel emotionally emotionally safe with, like you, hopefully, like your partner, can help not only them understand you better, but you understand yourself better. Mm-hmm. Another layer of that was we all have things that we value. I really value convenience. I will pay for parking like that. I love to just be able to drive in, park where I want, and they go, oh, you have to pay. I'll go, that's all right, I'm getting it, I'm paying. Whereas other people don't value that at all. And so if we were then in a couple together, they would go, why do you keep paying for parking when
there's a free park around the corner? What a waste of money, 5 minutes away. Yeah.
And, you know, that's a micro example, but we can also see this with cars and things like luxury goods. Those things mean different things to different people. Mm-hmm. And really understanding where you've come from and what money means to you when you're using it and when you're spending it and when you're saving it. It's the same with saving. Some people have much higher, I guess, standards for what security and freedom means to them. Most people, if you ask them what do they want money for, they'll go freedom and or security. But understanding what that means to you as an individual and how that might differ from your partner and how you can sort of bring together joint values or financial systems that accommodate both of your values, and that you understand that just because that person is behaving differently to you doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. It's just your values are slightly misaligned.
It's almost like,
you understand
it's like a bit
other,
like the love languages, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Interesting.
Little bit.
Really interesting. How important is it to have a support system, someone to make you accountable to try and change financial habits? You know, in whether that's success stories that you've seen with people you've worked with, or just from that psychological point of view, how does it help?
Having community and having conversations about money and breaking down that taboo is so important. Even doing the work that I do, it's put me into rooms with people that are doing similar things or that have come from different places, or maybe their big thing is teaching women about investing. And through being in those conversations and being somebody that goes, you know, I'm the first one at work drinks to go, right, what's everyone's salary? Obviously, if it's not prohibited, because it gives you awareness and proximity to different people's financial situations and the way that they're handling things, the amount that they get paid. It's critical when it comes down to gender and things like that, who's getting paid more in the workplace. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily a case of flipping a switch and just suddenly being okay with talking about money, but finding ways to start conversations with people you feel safe with, that are in similar kind of situations to you, can be helpful, because it can be jarring if you've got very different incomes.
Yeah,
or capacity.
That's the thing. It's the comparison piece, isn't it?
Mm.
And what people do present themselves like, oh, she's driving that, and you're like, oh, what, she does that? How's that? That math ain't. Mathing.
Interesting.
But I think, you know, as you said, having people that are like-minded, and it's not about, oh, I managed to save this amount, oh, you only managed to save that. You know, we all have different, you know, backgrounds and incomes, but to be sharing advice and, you know, just supporting each other, really crucial. I've got time for one last message. This is anonymous, but it kind of ties back to this idea of psychology around money, Emma, which says, I earn well, I live within my means, but I feel a sense of relief when I spend. Even if it's something boring like paying a bill or a traffic fine, I almost feel like I don't... It's almost like I don't think I should have money in the first place. Does that make sense? Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. This is quite common, actually. And an example I always use for this, and to help you kind of see how it might make more sense than it seems like it does... When you are sitting on the sofa and you know that you should go to the gym, but you can't be bothered.
Yeah, daily.
There's a big, yeah. Of course, there's that obvious motivation piece, but sometimes there's what's called a secondary benefit to not going. So you think that you want to go, everything about me wants to go, and I just can't. But sometimes there's almost a subconscious benefit to not going, because if you don't go, well, you're not perceived by people, or you're not going to be rejected for improving yourself by a community or your family or your friends.
Interesting.
Or there might be another experience that you're avoiding from a previous time that you've gone. Maybe you don't actually want to, I don't know, associate with something that what it would mean for you to change your fitness level or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the same kind of thing can apply here. It seems illogical. Why would you want to hand over money? Everybody wants money. But sometimes there's something secondary that you might be avoiding by making sure that you don't have money. If I were in a room with this person, I'd be questioning how were people with security and money viewed in their family, or maybe in their socioeconomic status, or what are their friends like? Do they earn more than they ever maybe thought that they would?
So a bit of imposter syndrome, perhaps.
Yeah, almost. It's sort of like when we don't apply for a job. We think, I want more money, I want a better job. But then we go, oh, I'm not really qualified. Because what would it mean for who we are to be at that level?
So it's sometimes we fear failure, but sometimes we actually fear success. You know what?
Absolutely.
That's really fascinating. I mean, we've run out of time, and I'm gutted, to be honest, because there's so much more I wanted to cover with you. But I would love to point people in direction of your book and the podcast. So do you want to give them a shout out so we can send people that way?
Of course, yeah. My podcast is called The Broke Generation Podcast. That is available worldwide. My book is called Good With Money. I'm not sure on the availability of it in Dubai.
We'll find a way.
There's Amazon and things like that. It's everywhere. And yeah, you can find me on Instagram at the.brokegeneration.
Tell you what, we'll manifest. If you send me the word money to 4001, I will send you the link so you can find Emma. So worth a follow on Instagram in terms of treating some really heavy topics with a light hand and an expert insight that I think a lot of us can really benefit from. Emma, thank you so, so much. Really appreciate your time today and the time difference. And I'll see you on the gram. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.